curtailed though it was by the Allied strategic bomber offensive, German armaments production was benefiting from Todt's and Speer's rationalization measures and from the Europe-wide influx of labor to produce enough of the right sorts of weapon. Armament efforts were also now far more targeted than before. In January 1944, the army announced that infantry weapon types would be reduced from 20 to 8. The equivalent figure for anti-tank weapons was from 12 to 1, for flak from 10 to 2, for artillery from 26 to 8, and for tanks and armored fighting vehicles, AFVs, from 18 to 7. Some of the weaponry that now found its way to the infantry was especially effective. The Germans often deployed 7.5-centimeter guns behind their main defensive line to engage any Soviet tanks that broke through before the Soviet infantry came up. When increasingly heavy losses compelled the Ostheer to thin out these artillery support units, it relied increasingly upon its infantry to operate mobile anti-tank weapons themselves. The most versatile, cheap to produce, reasonably lightweight and operable from different positions, was the Panzerfaust. As enemy armor came to fear the Panzerfaust, so did enemy infantry come to fear the MG-42 machine gun. This weapon, which replaced the MG-34, could fire 1,200 rounds per minute, wasteful but deadly against soldiers caught in the open. Then there was the Sturmgewehr, a assault rifle which could be fired on the move automatically. There was a limit to the German infantry's firepower. In particular, assault rifles were never manufactured in the quantities needed. But the new weaponry was highly effective when used, particularly in an interlocking field of fire. As for the infantry's armor support, joining the Panzers and Sturmgeschütze was a new generation of tank destroyers, cheaper to produce for their lack of a revolving turret, yet formidably armed. The augmented armor and firepower of this new generation was clear in its name. The hunting tank or Jagdpanzer, rather than the more lightly armed and armored Panzerjäger of old. Jagdpanzers were fitted with all-round armor and based on medium or heavy panzer designs. The most famous Jagdpanzers were the Jagdpanzer IV and above all the Jagdpanther. Though they could no longer muster the strength for large counterattacks or for sustained defense against major Soviet offensives, the panzer formations could still blunt and counter Red Army attacks. Panzer formations continued operating on the combined arms battle group principle. Now, however, the same principle applied not just to panzer divisions and smaller units, but also to panzer armies and panzer corps. The main thing driving this was necessity. Because the German army no longer possessed the resources to maintain a large offensive armored force, panzer formations now had to mix armored and non-armored units and concentrate them in defense. What such groups could achieve, even under the most hastily improvised conditions, was exemplified by the 359th Infantry Division. In March 1944, as General Balck later recalled, the 359th conducted a fighting retreat that enabled his 48 Panzer Corps to stabilize its front in the Ukraine temporarily along the River Siret. With 5 Tigers, 1 platoon of engineers, and assorted supply clerks, they held 2 Russian infantry divisions in check, conducting several courageous counterattacks along the division's 20-kilometer-deep open flank. As enemy air power and firepower increased, battle groups were broken down in size so as to maximize their mobility and make them less easily detectable. The Germans also grew adept, again out of necessity, at camouflaging men and machines. That the Germans' armored formations could still get the better of their opponents was attested to by Wachtmeister Josef L., who on New Year's Day 1944 recalled, "A few days ago I saw with my own eyes how one German assault gun, which was operating not far from me, destroyed 6 Russian tanks with 7 shots." Such cases exemplify in microcosm why Stalin and the Red Army leadership still rated the Germans as dangerous opponents, and did not attempt an even larger, more decisive offensive until the summer of 1944. They had been nastily surprised by the Germans' continuing operational superiority at Kharkov in May 1942 and March 1943, and did not wish to relive the experience. German soldiers of whatever weapons branch also endured because they were rightly terrified of the German military justice system. During the first year of the war, 112 German soldiers had been executed. Most of these had been conscientious objectors, and most of these, in turn, had been Jehovah's Witnesses. But this death toll was dwarfed by the one that the German military justice system visited upon the Army's troops during the war's final 2 years. As German fortunes on the Eastern Front continued to wane, military courts grew ever more anxious that morale and discipline might collapse, just as they supposedly had in 1918. From 1943 onwards, military courts were far less preoccupied than before with more routine breakdowns in discipline, which, among other things, may explain why Ferdinand M.'s drinking binge of August 1943 apparently went unpunished, or with conduct that damaged the Army's image among the occupied population. Indeed, as has been seen, some officers believed the troops should be allowed to behave harshly towards civilians as a safety valve for their frustrations. There were 1,671 cases of plunder for the whole German army in 1941, a figure that rose to 2,601 3 years later. If both numbers seem relatively low, that may be because numerous cases of plunder went unreported, due in turn to officers' tolerance of it, especially in the East. The fact that recorded cases of plunder had risen sharply by 1944 was probably down to the chaos and indiscipline of the retreats of that year. By now, the military court's biggest worry was desertion. November 1943 saw the formation of the Feldjägerkorps, FJK, or Military Police Corps. Its tasks were to pick up deserters, prevent panic retreats, and gather up stragglers and send them back to stiffen the front line. By the time the war reached German soil, the FJK also had authority to execute deserters as well as round up party functionaries and send them to the front. Over the course of the war, around 15,000 German soldiers, equivalent to an entire infantry division, were shot or beheaded for desertion. Another 10,000, half of whom were also executed, were punished for self-inflicted wounds. The most dramatic statistic, however, is that between June 1941 and November 1944, the number of cases of indiscipline or desertion in the army doubled, but the number of death sentences increased 18-fold. Paragraph 5 of the wartime special penal code, Kriegssonderstrafrechtsverordnung, or KSSTVO, contained several other offences, such as anti-regime comments, that also brought the death penalty. In the Ninth Army, the peak months for passing death sentences were April 1943 and October 1943. Between 25 and 30 soldiers were executed in each of these 2 months. Across the army, many who were not executed were assigned to punishment battalions, a sentence that often anyway amounted to death. Guy Zeyer, who underwent army training in Poland in September 1942, witnessed close up the ferocity of the treatment that was dealt out to soldiers for even lesser offences. Soldiers being disciplined spent their 36 hours of active training like everyone else. However, at the end of this period, they were led to the Hundehütte, doghouse, and chained with their wrists behind their backs to a heavy horizontal beam. Their 8-hour rest period would be spent in this position. Soup was brought to them in one of the big tureens for 8, from which they had to lap like dogs. Even cleaning out latrines with a toothbrush would have been preferable to this. Not only the severity of the sentence, but also the judge's interpretation of military law were designed to terrify the soldiers into obedience. According to Rudolf Lehmann, the Wehrmacht's senior lawyer, justice is what benefits the people. Weighed against this, the rights of the individual defendant counted for little, if anything. This, of course, chimed exactly with Nazi ideology's view of the rights of individuals in society. The barbarization of military justice, then, was not merely a panicked response to a worsening military situation, even though the military situation infused the business of sentencing with greater urgency. It was also a natural result of Nazism's ever more pervasive influence within the army. The army carried out 19,600 death sentences during the Second World War, compared with 146 for the U.S. Army and just 44 for the British. Then again, the Red Army ascribed even more importance to terrorizing its own soldiers, executing 150,000 of them over the course of the war. The Army's training and replacement system was under ever greater pressure, but continued to hold. It sought to counteract the effects of increasingly short training programs, introducing, for example, special training courses for senior troop commanders in July 1943. Divisions also carried out top-up training of new recruits after they arrived at the front. Army training was also becoming more ferocious, if Guy Zayer's experience is any guide. We all put in 36-hour shifts, which were broken by only 3 half-hour periods, during which we devoured the contents of our mess tins before returning to the ranks in obligatory clean and orderly condition. At the end of these 36 hours, we were allowed 8 hours rest. Then there was another 36-hour period. There were also false alarms, which tore us from our leaden sleep and forced us into the courtyard fully dressed and equipped. Sometimes a fellow would drop from exhaustion. Training as brutal as this was designed to harden the troops against the miserable, parlous conditions of the front. Such was Zaya's own comment about his instructor. He wasn't really a bully, but a man with a clear idea of a job to be done. He made us realize, rightly enough, that if we couldn't stand a little cold and a vague possible danger, we would never survive at the front. Even so, training overall was increasingly truncated, patchy, and improvised. A more fundamental reason why frontline units held it together was that, despite their often grievous casualty rates, enough units seemed to have retained a core of older veterans, thanks partly to the return of convalescence among their ranks and their NCOs. These were men who were sufficiently tough and experienced and sufficiently lucky to have avoided being killed or invalided. Where possible, wounded soldiers were returned to their unit following convalescence. In this way, many units retained a consistent, durable core of manpower, and new recruits found a bedrock of experienced soldiers who enabled them to survive longer and gain experience themselves. Thus did the troops' self-supporting primary groups endure. "My unit was my home, my family," wrote Hans Werner Woltersdorf, "which I had to protect." By 1943, the rate of loss along the whole front, even in the then still relatively quiet sector of Army Group North, made it impossible to keep allocating troops to units raised in their home region. Yet the replacement system was still extensively able to do this, even if no longer entirely able. Now, however, there was a downside. If a division hailed from a region being heavily bombed, its morale could suffer, for many of its soldiers would then fear for their families and homes. Typical of many letters written at this time was Corporal Waldo Pies from June 1943. "Herr Kronenberg, my old boss from 1935 to 36, has written telling me that Hamburg is a sea of rubble." He then wrote of a woman, presumably a female relative, "She has lost everything in Hamburg. She could only save her own life. It's good that Uncle Conrad was found and pulled out of the rubble, but it's awful that every town is being affected and must undergo this sort of misery." In any case, commanders recognized how important it was for units to keep their primary groups going. In December 1943, Major Graf von Rittberg of FHO recommended that newly arrived replacements must be placed with a combat-experienced commander and troops if they are to adapt quickly to the harsh battle conditions of the East and achieve great things. Indeed, as officer casualties mounted, it was not unheard of for NCOs to become officers. Sometimes higher command did not get round to replacing officers at all, and NCOs acted as a long-term stopgap. Considering the importance the German Army had placed upon NCO training since Reichswehr days, the fact that German Army NCOs made good officers, de facto or otherwise, is unsurprising. Morale, too, was fundamental to keeping soldiers resilient. While that is stating the obvious, less obvious are the elements that contributed to the morale of the Ostheer. The army sought to maintain the morale of its troops by entertaining them, provisioning them, tending to their religious needs, and instilling ideological or national political attitudes within them. How effectively it achieved the fourth of these objectives is an especially complex question, for it was determined by the army's evolving social character and the course of the war itself. Troop entertainment constituted part of the troop's spiritual care, geistige Betreuung, and was the responsibility of the intelligence sections of all army formations from divisions upwards. Intelligence sections arranged for civilian and military newspapers, books, and home comforts such as cigarettes to be distributed to the troops. Radio broadcasts from the Reich and feature films were provided, as well as live performances by touring companies of the Kraft durch Freude organization. Despite the Wehrmacht's ongoing efforts to expose the troops to Nazi ideology, much of this entertainment was of a form that most major armies of the Second World War would have recognized. The 16th and 18th armies provide a snapshot of the entertainment the troops were receiving. In the winter of 1942 to 1943, the 16th Army's intelligence section believed that, as long as the front remained static, the troops would have ample time on their hands. Printing presses and numerous libraries for the frontline troops would be provided in the various towns of the Army's jurisdiction, and each division was to receive three large common rooms. The intelligence section sought to provide trucks for film shows and partly to ease the pressure on the KDF organization in its efforts to cover the East, to enable the troops themselves to put on their own music concerts. Where possible, the KDF organization, together with local performers, also laid on entertainment. According to the 18th Army's intelligence section, a typical KDF group might include acrobats, a comedian, an accordion player, and a female dancer. A 16th Army report of February 1943 also described the periodical reading matter with which the troops were provided. The newspaper Ostfront Illustrierte was popular because it was lavishly illustrated with photos and contains less in the way of recent events and photos depicting the war, but rather presents the soldier with the beauty and value of the homeland for which he fights. More popular still were the title lifted from the lyrics of the phenomenally successful Lili Marlene, sung by Lala Andersen, was the illustrated magazine Unter der Lanterne. That said, the 18th Army's intelligence section highlighted some of the obstacles that could disrupt the leisure and entertainment drive. Poor transport connections prevented it from getting more books to the front. Frontline conditions hindered the troops' efforts to lay on their own entertainments, particularly sketch shows, and both problems got in the way of KDF visits. Nor was the intelligence section consistently enamored of the quality of the KDF shows that did take place. It recognized the hard work the KDF groups put in, but recommended smaller, more select KDF parties so that the troops did not have to sit through performances of such varying quality. The 18th Army also found it hard to secure electric current for the buildings in which film shows were due to take place. General Bulk witnessed firsthand the laughably lamentable effects of a KDF performance upon off-duty troops of the 11th Panzer Division. The old warriors were sitting in the theater, full of expectations, their eyes were focused on the stage. An actor came out emphatically singing his song, "Oh, what fun it is to be a soldier." A booing and jeering chant swept through the audience. The actor recovered quickly and countered with another song. "That cannot possibly rattle a sailor. The front line and the rear will never understand each other. This bordered on sabotage, but I laughed my heart out." Film shows were among the most sought-after forms of troop entertainment. In June 1943, medical NCO Helmut P. of the 198th Infantry Division wrote, "We had to deal with another stomach wound yesterday. I went along to the main theater to attend the operation. But things didn't get that far, for the man was already dead. He had bled to death, and his spine was shot up as well. Yes, this is war in reality, not as it seems from the beer table. It's the cinema this afternoon. White lilacs. I'm really looking forward to seeing something civilized." Jülfried K. of the 25th Panzergrenadier Division was another keen cinema-goer. "Another surprise to tell you about. The film car has just arrived. That means there'll be field entertainment right on the front line. At the railway station there's a big administrative building, which has been decked out with balconies by our pioneer troops. Tonight it will stage the premiere of The White Horse Inn." Perhaps the single most important entertainment medium was the radio, for this served not only as a source of entertainment, but also as a link with families back home. Radio shows accepted soldiers' requests for musical numbers, Lili Marlene being the most popular of all, and conveyed personal messages to and from the troops in return for charity donations. But perhaps even more important to morale was the Wehrmacht Postal Service, because writing and receiving letters provided the troops with the most intimate contact with home. The effect could be double-edged, nevertheless, particularly if a soldier suspected his wife or girlfriend no longer cared for him or was going astray. On the other hand, letters containing expressions of love, emotional, familial, or carnal, could improve a soldier's morale profoundly. A particularly striking aspect of soldiers' letters is how they could also foster a connection between a soldier and his children. The soldiers' letters often expressed an active interest in their children's social and educational development. One father at the front received schoolwork from his son and queries about homework. Another reprimanded his children for truanting. Many soldiers' letters also asked their children to help their mothers in various ways. In 1943 and 1944, the German economy, aided by the Reich's intensifying exploitation of occupied Europe, could still supply the troops' essential day-to-day needs. As long as we have fuel for our trucks, supply and munitions, no problem remains unsolved, wrote Lieutenant E.W. of the 12th Panzer Division at the end of November 1943. In mid-December, his comrade in the division, Corporal B.R., wrote, "Sometimes it's hard, but the German soldier now is well kitted out for the Russian winter. Warm clothes and, above all, nice warm felt boots. If the homeland wasn't supplying us so well, then it really would be going badly for us." That same month, Corporal O of the 12th Panzer Division lauded the home comforts that were laid on. "I must say, all of us who are in the service are well supplied. We receive cigarettes, tobacco, and also schnapps, and the famous frontline packages with various sweet things." Soldiers also found their religious needs catered for, albeit within limits. The army came to undervalue the provision of religious services as it grew closer to Nazism, and in May 1940, Field Marshal von Brauchitsch had further watered down the army's commitment to religiosity by reiterating, "Participation in church services can only be voluntary." Yet Christian beliefs remained a constant in the lives of many German soldiers. The 253rd Infantry Division was a fourth wave division raised in the 6th Military District, which encompassed the western provinces of Westphalia, Hanover, and the Rhineland. It counted slightly more Catholics than Protestants among its personnel, but soldiers of both denominations saw their chaplains as an important support for coping with personal fears and problems. The chaplains endeavored to reach all the division's units through services, sermons, and welfare activities. In the 129th Infantry Division, Josef L., who considered himself a disillusioned former Catholic, wrote in April 1943, "I'm just back from a Protestant service. At the very least, it was a nice change from everyday frontline life. The young chaplain spoke very well, and I believe he was able to bolster some of the weaker souls. A gramophone played lovely organ music and hymns. I'm certainly not inclined to make fun of church services. There are many comrades who are only able to build strong and resilient hearts in these difficult times by praying to God." Yet the most complex source of morale was not the soldiers' spiritual beliefs, but their ideological beliefs. Officers played the central role in imparting Nazi ideology to their troops. Hitler had long sought an officer corps that promoted men for their ability and character, particularly courage, charisma, and endurance, and considered frontline experience a far better guide to character than service on the staff. Doubtless the memory of Field Marshal Paulus, himself a former staff officer, surrendering the 6th Army at Stalingrad only reinforced Hitler's conviction. As the end of the Battle of Stalingrad loomed, the OKH made a renewed effort to intensify the troops' spiritual care, and with it their indoctrination. "The current war," it announced on 24 January 1943, "is born, like no other, of the dynamic of the political ideologies of the age." It particularly urged a greater push to get indoctrination material to the Army's field training divisions. Shortly after Stalingrad fell, Major Freiherr von Lersner produced an alarming record of a tour he made of the field armies of Army Group Center. "The soldier asks why the 6th Army couldn't be helped," he reported. "In his opinion, we've come too far forward to pull the front back." The German soldier, according to Lerner, still considered himself superior to his Russian opponent, despite his opponent's greater resources. Nevertheless, Lerner stressed, some field armies were worse placed than others. The 9th Army had a good personality in the shape of General Model at its head, and had always successfully beaten off enemy attacks. But the 4th Army had grown sluggish after seeing no meaningful action in the past 10 months, while the 3rd Panzer Army, in contrast, had been exhausted by a surfeit of heavy combat. Lerzner urged a more imaginative political approach to the war in the East, pointing out that the 1943 warrior is a different man from the one of 1939. He hates clichés and whitewashing and wants to be given the facts and given them in his own language. Anything that looks like propaganda he instinctively rejects. Other field armies echoed Lerzner's call in the aftermath of Stalingrad. The intelligence section of the 20th Mountain Army, serving in Russia's far north, proclaimed, "Standing between the threatening violence of Bolshevism and the Anglo-American plutocracy, Germany fights as leader of Europe for all the human and spiritual values of the thousand-year-old European culture. In this total war, the final victory will be ours only if all the powers of spirit and character are employed as intensively as those of the military and technical." It ordered each of its divisional commanders to charge a suitable officer with responsibility for a broad approach to national political instruction, one that relied on more than just the daily Wehrmacht reports and political communications. In November 1943, the High Command similarly announced the introduction of National Socialist Leadership Officers, Nationalsozialistische Führungsoffiziere, or NSFOs, across the entire Wehrmacht. NSFOs were to be Wehrmacht officers who ticked the following boxes: unconditional National Socialist, outstanding performance at the front, experience and practical abilities in political ideological guidance and education. The Army, Kriegsmarine and Luftwaffe already had ideological guidance staffs. This, plus the urgency with which all three service branches regarded the task, led them to implement the NSFO directive with remarkable consistency. It is not clear that the NSFOs were especially effective. Indeed, some field formations did not attach the necessary importance to their brief of ideological instruction. General of Infantry Walter Weiss, commander of the Second Army, complained that providing the troops with entertainment and material welfare took up so much time that there was none left to attend to the NSFOs' ideological tasks. But the main reason why NSFOs appear to have made relatively little impact was that unit officers themselves were the most effective conveyors of National Socialist ideology. For as Colonel Freiherr von Lerzner had realized, unit officers, particularly those young enough to have been schooled in Nazi thinking, had the opportunity not only to impart such thinking to their men, but also to lead by example. In April 1943, General Balck, at that point acting commander of the Grossdeutschland division, instructed his officers in the messages he expected them to convey and the example he expected them to set. "Mental power of resistance has to be repeatedly strengthened, particularly during rest periods. This will be achieved by the uniform orientation of commanders and troops in ideological issues, strengthening of soldierly qualities, bravery, toughness, the will to fight and obey, the recognition of the historical significance of the war, creation of a confident view of the military and political situation even in the face of setbacks and the length of the war, instilling a steadfast spirit in crises." Such were casualty rates among commissioned officers that they were often not around long enough to become experienced and gain their men's full respect. And, because they often needed to gather enough experience to compensate for having been trained in a hurry, or needed to acclimatize following occupation duty, new officers who did last longer often needed more time to bed in than their predecessors. But if the extensively studied divisions, such as the Grossdeutschland, the 18th Panzer, and the 12th and 253rd Infantry, are any guide, the great majority of officers came from the sorts of middle-class circles that had been either comparatively or very well disposed towards Nazism during the 1930s. This does not mean that they were ideological zealots. Army officers' personnel files tend to describe their subjects as brave, tough, and steadfast, rather than as fanatical or self-sacrificing. The latter sort of language was more at home in the personnel files of the Waffen-SS. Solid National Socialist appears almost routinely in Army officers' personnel files, but so routinely as to appear a catch-all phrase. The Army's officer corps, then, was not a body of Nazi fanatics, but a great deal of it could identify with the ethos of Hitler's ideal National Socialist Army. Both officers and NCOs who did endure, meanwhile, could make a stronger claim to having got where they were on merit. The courage, endurance, and strength of character that Hitler considered the most important officer selection criteria. Indeed, while a wartime American opinion survey among German POWs at Fort Hunt, Washington, D.C., found that two-thirds of them rated the quality of German officers highly, a figure that would have been higher still but for the inexperience of younger officers, more than three-quarters rated their NCOs highly. Furthermore, NCOs were more likely than officers to hail from all walks of life. The 253rd Infantry Division's officers, for example, were predominantly from a middle-class or upper-middle-class background at the war's start, whereas its NCOs were split by a factor of 3 to 1 between the working class and middle class. As NCOs assumed an ever more important leadership role at the front, the German army came increasingly to resemble the true people's army beloved of Nazi ideals. Meanwhile, as losses mounted and the average age of officers fell, a growing number of officers within these divisions were men who had been socialized in Nazi organizations such as the Hitler Youth and the Reich Labor Service. There were also other important markers of social change across the army. By the end of 1942, for instance, 9% of officer candidates came from the industrial working class or agricultural laboring class. While this figure was low as a proportion of the German population, the figure before the war had been 0%. As Hitler himself said in a speech of September 1942, "When you look at the promotion of our younger officers, the penetration of our National Socialist Volksgemeinschaft has already begun here in its full extent. There is no privilege given to a birthday certificate, to a previous position in life, there is no conception of wealth, no so-called origins. There is only a sole evaluation, that is, the assessment of the brave, courageous, loyal man who is suited to be the leader of our people." The officer corps did not become socially diluted overnight. The process had been in train since the mid-1930s, when Hitler announced the army's initial expansion. However, the war accelerated the process, and by 1943 the effects were even more noticeable. Practically speaking, neither the growing importance of NCOs nor the officer corps' lower class profile automatically made all frontline leaders staunch Nazis. But the more socially diluted the officer corps, the less socially cohesive it was. Thus, at all levels, the upper middle class or aristocratic ethos that had once characterized the officer corps was no longer strong enough to provide any of the sense of social identity that had enabled the officer corps to cohere around something other than Nazi belief. So disappeared an important check on the Nazification that increasingly consumed the officer corps. The social transformation of the officer corps also eroded its distinctive Protestant identity. There was some denominational leveling out between Protestants and Catholics, and in 1942, 8 times as many officers described themselves as free thinkers, neither Protestant nor Catholic, than had been the case among the last officer class to pass out during peacetime. This is not to say that Protestants were intrinsically more resistant to Nazism than Catholics were. Indeed, among Reich Germans at least, pre-1933 election results suggest the opposite. However, just as the officer corps' distinct social identity grew weaker, so too did its distinct religious identity. This development similarly widened the void that Nazi belief was able to fill. In any case, the national Protestant mentality stressed fatherland, loyalty, and sacrifice, and the importance of serving without discussion, all qualities that chimed perfectly with Nazism. Army priests, Protestant and Catholic, also felt intense antipathy towards communism. Though given the intense antipathy communism felt towards religion, this is hardly surprising. The shaping of frontline soldiers' thinking, then, was increasingly in the hands of officers and NCOs for whom Nazi values were a strong collective motivator, and who themselves increasingly embodied the socially leveled ideal of the Volksgemeinschaft. This may be one reason why many frontline soldiers genuinely believed in the Volksgemeinschaft. The psychologist H.L. Ansbacher's study of German POWs in Allied captivity found that soldiers from a working-class background felt more faith in Hitler than almost any other occupational group in Germany. "Hitler's only mistake was that we lost the war," opined a POW who had been a miner. Ansbacher also found that many POWs felt positively about the Nazis' employment and social welfare policies, and about what they saw as the Nazis' replacement of class division with communal unity. "We just feel ourselves to be the heralds of our future nation," wrote one soldier in September 1943. "There are no individual destinies here." Clearly, the socialist in National Socialist resonated with many. But with the Red Army advancing westwards, Wehrmacht propaganda spent less time invoking the ideals of the Volksgemeinschaft than it did inciting the troops' fear and revulsion of Jewish Bolshevism, and of the supposed consequences of a triumphant Red Army being let loose on the German people. By late 1943, the Wehrmacht's indoctrination effort employed increasingly shrill language to depict the war in the East as a defensive struggle against a Judeo-Bolshevik onrush that threatened to destroy both Germany and Western civilization. Plenty of soldiers were receptive, partly because of the years of ideological conditioning they had already undergone, but not only because of that. Now, fear made them more receptive still. In early November, Corporal Werner F. of the 12th Panzer Division wrote, "In Russia, we really learned what would happen if the Russians came to Germany. But if front and homeland stand strongly together, this will never happen." 90% of the POWs questioned at Fort Hunt claimed to have a negative view of the Soviet Union. It was a view born of both anti-Bolshevism and the fear of Soviet vengeance. On the other hand, if fear and hatred of the enemy was the prime motive that kept the Frontsoldat in the fight, that does not account for why 860,000 German soldiers surrendered on the Eastern Front between 1941 and 1944. And many German soldiers grudgingly respected the fighting qualities of their Soviet opponents. Those people have a terrific toughness of spirit and body. They fight to the very last. The Russians, my God, they can fight. You wouldn't believe how fanatically the devils fought. Such sentiments typified the opinion soldiers expressed after capture by the Western Allies. Yet even then, the Red Army soldier's very disdain for death could make him look even more bestial to the dogmatic eyes of his opponents. Near Uman, in that first battle of encirclement in the Ukraine, related General Kruvel in British captivity, "My tanks literally had to crush the people to death because they wouldn't give themselves up." And though they might not have expressed it as such, soldiers' knowledge of and sometimes participation in Nazi crimes doubtless made them even more fearful of what a vengeful Red Army might do once it reached German soil. The same fear of what the enemy was capable of also doubtless discouraged a great many German soldiers from crossing the lines. And even though German soldiers did surrender on the Eastern Front, the fighting in the West in 1944 and 1945 would show that soldiers fighting there were a great deal readier to surrender than soldiers fighting in the East were. Moreover, although so much of the blame for the unfolding debacle on the Eastern Front was Hitler's, faith in the Führer seems to have remained a key ingredient in many soldiers' belief systems. On 24 January 1943, with defeat at Stalingrad looming, an OKH directive credited Hitler with forging a fatherland of comradeship. He has abolished the walls that divide, kept intact honor for all, and has given everyone justice and a sense of duty. His organizations, such as the Party, SA, SS, Hitler Youth, the Winter Aid Scheme, professional organizations, and above all the Wehrmacht, that arose again by his order, are the greatest system for educating comrades in the thoughts of the Führer. Major Freiherr von Lersner's tour of Army Group Center in February 1943 impressed upon him the troops' regard and love for Adolf Hitler as Führer and creator of the Reich. The decisive issue is the connection between the Führer and everyone else. A visit he paid to the 1st Panzer Army in November 1943 likewise conveyed the regard in which the troops still held Hitler. Lersner also stressed that deepening the relationship between the Führer and the Army will undoubtedly double its fighting power. Both SD morale reports and numerous soldiers' letters seem to bear out Lersner's view. On 26 October, for instance, Lieutenant Heiner B. of the 12th Panzer Division proclaimed, "That we must and can hold on is beyond question. It is a question of faith in the Führer." Jülfried K. wrote on 19 December, "In the coming year we want to remain unshakably true to our oath of allegiance and follow our Führer in blind faith and belief in our final victory." During the war's final phase, the Nazi propaganda machine also credited Hitler with devising the new Wunderwaffen that would turn the tide in Germany's favor as long as the front-line troops held on long enough for them to be brought into action. It is little wonder that many soldiers clung to this prospect. Michael H., an Unteroffizier with 1st Mountain Division, hoped in June 1944 that all our new devices will bring the enemy to his knees as soon as possible. What a wonderful lift for the fighting morale of our people it would be if these new weapons could have a decisive success, wrote Josef L. that same month. We hope for the best. The English should experience what we've had to endure for months in the homeland. The Messerschmitt 262 jet fighter, the V-1 flying bomb and the V-2 rocket would not be ready for action until late 1944, and even then their impact would be negligible. Until then, however, they carried the hopes of many ordinary Germans in and out of uniform who were petrified at the prospect of defeat and its consequences. In many ways, Nazism was also a perfect partner for traditional military ethics. Its strident militarism appealed to many career soldiers. Nazism also prized military professionalism. This chimed particularly with specialists such as engineers who took special pride in their expertise, and with elite units. Among these were the Army's Panzer troops. The mood among the Panzer men has always been the best and will remain so, wrote Corporal W.B. of the 12th Panzer Division in December 1943. The Panzer Regiment is and remains the spiritual and moral backbone of the division. Equally resonant with military sensibilities was Nazism's stress on individual endeavor. Many POWs in Fort Hunt considered not returning home with a decoration to be a source of shame. Not all soldiers might be set on winning a decoration, but those in positions of authority, or who aspired to such a position, found that a decoration strengthened their men's regard for them. In May 1943, for example, Lieutenant Helmut H. of the 258th Infantry Division reported, "Now Colonel Volkowitz and a lieutenant of ours have received the Knight's Cross. That naturally unleashed great joy. A good acquaintance of mine, Captain R., was mentioned in the German Army's Honours Bulletin. I was particularly pleased about that. He ought to get the Knight's Cross as well." And the combination of aggression, initiative, and resourcefulness was something that united both the Nazis' Führerprinzip and the Army's Auftragstaktik. Whether it was its strategic situation or the condition of its soldiers, the Ostheer was indeed an army in decline during 1943 and early 1944. But its defense remained resilient enough and its organization cohesive enough to enable its troops to endure. And though the German front was pushed back westwards, sector by sector, it did not collapse. Backing it were a war economy and a replacement system that was still able to generate the necessary levels of weaponry, recruitment, and training. At the front itself, the presence of able and experienced NCOs, men who, like their officers, were familiar with the principles of Auftragstaktik, proved essential. Though this was not an army of ideological fanatics, Nazi attitudes and beliefs permeated it. They did so partly because of the welter of ideological instruction that the troops had hitherto received and now increasingly received, instruction that, in the case of younger soldiers, also buttressed a process to which they had been subjected through their childhood and youth. Much of this instruction, as before, centered around the figure of Hitler himself. Yet the Ostheer was also characterized by a powerful Nazi belief system because such a system was the most unifying characteristic of its increasingly diffuse officer corps. Nazism also chimed with soldiers because of the close relationship between Nazi values and more traditional military values. How far each element of this picture inspired and enabled the ordinary soldier to fight on was something that varied across an army so vast and so diverse in its social makeup and professional capabilities. Faith in the figure of Hitler himself also remained strong. Nevertheless, much of the Ostheer's staying power was born of more commonplace forces, such as contact with home and troop entertainment. Some of these forces, however, were profoundly malign, not least the Wehrmacht's increasingly murderous system of military discipline. And what doubtless fortified a great many soldiers in a very basic way, regardless of how Nazified they were, was their fear of the Red Army. In what was undoubtedly one of the deadliest environments on earth, a more universal incentive to fight was the fundamental need to stay alive, for the sake not just of oneself, but also of one's comrades. The elemental day-to-day importance of comradeship is demonstrated by an incident that Guy Zeyer recalled. Sick of the front and hopeless in spirit, he tried to get himself killed by jumping out of his foxhole, before one of his comrades, Hulse, pulled him back. "Let the hell go of me. What business is it of yours anyway? What difference does it make?" "The difference is that I need to see your face from time to time, the way I need to see the veteran or that bastard Lindberg." A violent shiver engulfed my whole body. Tears continued to pour down my cheeks, and I felt like kissing my poor friend's filthy face. We began another interminable night of fear in a dark hole, with an exhaustion so heavy one wished to die. We listened to the cries of our fellow combatants. We hardly spoke during that night, but I knew that I should try to live for the sake of my friend. National Socialist ideology's own stress on comradeship, which it had sought particularly to instill in the Army's younger soldiers ever since their days in the Hitler Youth, undoubtedly played a significant role in further impressing its importance upon the troops. Indeed, it will be clear from these pages that the proliferation and potency of Nazi values across the Ostheer should not be downplayed. Their most important impact on the combat performance of the troops on the Eastern Front in 1944 was less upon their willingness to fight than upon their ability to fight. Yet the level at which they made this effect felt was so basic as to have less to do with Nazi values than with the essential qualities any officer needed in order to lead, and any soldier needed in order to survive, within such a hellish environment as the Eastern Front. Nazi ideology placed great importance upon qualities such as courage, endurance, resourcefulness, and strength of character, as well as upon comradeship. So too did the German military's long-standing ethos of Auftragstaktik, one to which it had long subscribed not for ideological reasons, but because it got the best performance out of the troops. But most fundamentally, so too did any officer seeking to keep his men alive, and any soldier wishing to return from the Eastern Front alive. From the particular point of view of fighting power, then, National Socialist warfare now meant fighting to survive by another name. Chapter 20. Italy, 1943-1944. When the Allies invaded mainland Italy, the German forces under Field Marshal Kesselring ensured they encountered not Churchill's soft underbelly, but 20 months of dogged resistance. The Gustav Line south of Rome and the Germans' epic defense of Cassino in the line's center became bywords for their determination to sell Italian soil as dearly as possible. Kesselring resolved to make the Gustav Line so strong that the British and Americans will break their teeth on it. The German army in Italy gave a formidable performance in defensive warfare, albeit a performance overshadowed by the often savage conduct of its units during the anti-partisan campaign. So proximate were these two sides of the conflict that they gave the Italian campaign an unusual hybrid quality. In September 1943, with the Allies firmly ashore after their landings at Calabria and Salerno, the Germans had to decide between two courses of action. Field Marshal Rommel, commanding Army Group B, wanted them to withdraw and establish a new defense line in northern Italy, south of the Alps. This, he believed, would shorten the German supply lines and give them an impenetrable natural barrier to defend. But Field Marshal Kesselring, commander of Army Group C, managed to persuade Hitler with an entirely different argument. Kesselring maintained that defending Italy from the bottom up would be an excellent opportunity to subject the Allies to a grueling campaign of attrition. The Germans could not actually hold Italy, but they could put up a fierce defense of a sequence of resistance lines, withdraw from each when the pressure became too great, and so force the Allies to advance as slowly and painfully as possible. A steady fighting retreat would also give the Germans time to subject the country to scorched earth measures and seize Italian civilians for labor. Above all, Kesselring argued, the Italian front would draw away troops that the Allies would otherwise be committing to an invasion of northwest Europe. Kesselring was also aware that many of the divisions he could count on were high-quality formations from the OKW's Central Mobile Reserve. Accordingly, on 21 November, Hitler appointed Kesselring to the new post of Commander Southwest. Rommel assumed command of Army Group B in France, and with it much of the responsibility for defensive preparations against Allied invasion there. But in the event, the campaign that followed drained the Germans more than it did the Allies. In September 1943, the Germans had 16 divisions stationed in Italy. By the autumn of 1944, that figure had doubled, divided between the 10th and 14th armies. By the end of the campaign on the Italian mainland, the Allies had suffered 312,000 dead, but the Germans had suffered more than 415,000. Nor could the Germans sustain such losses as well as the Allies. Quite apart from the harrowing human cost to both sides, this was a poor rate of return for a war of attrition that the Germans themselves had instigated. The Germans' death toll partly reflected the poor quality of some of their troops. Not all of them hailed from the OKW's Central Mobile Reserve. For instance, while General von Zenger-Etterlin considered the 15th Panzergrenadier Division to be thoroughly reliable, he had far less regard for the 1st Panzergrenadier Division. This contained a large number of ethnic Germans from Poland, in the army on probation and distinctly lacking in motivation. "I got the impression," Zenger-Etterlin later recalled, "that even the German elements among the troops had been shaken by the many reverses and uninterrupted withdrawals." But perhaps more than anything else, the Germans' death toll reflected their extremely limited air cover in the Italian campaign. Following the massacre of the Luftwaffe in the Mediterranean theatre in July 1943, and the Allied aerial dominance that those losses signified, the Luftwaffe pulled out most of its formations from the Mediterranean theatre, leaving only a token force in Italy. Thus, for example, Allied landings at Anzio, southwest of Rome, in January 1944, were protected by 2,700 aircraft. Against them, the German 2nd Air Fleet could muster only 233. The peril to the troops on the ground was immense. In February 1944, Lieutenant Peter G. of the 114th Light Division, recently transferred from Yugoslavia, wrote, "In the air, the Tommies really know their stuff. Every truck, every train is targeted during the day. The enemy's 1,100% air superiority makes you want to throw up." He also seethed at the Allies' immense land-based firepower, something the world has not yet seen. 14 hours of heavy barrage, 3 kilometers, 2 miles wide, from 100 meters, 330 feet, of barrels with 100,000 shots. If only our Luftwaffe could at least help us, but far and wide it is nowhere to be seen. Against this, the enemy Jabos, fighter bombers, snap at every single truck and every single man with bombs, cannon, and machine guns. And amid all this, the enemy's phosphorus bombs crash into our section, burning man and mouse. General von Zenger-Etterlin concurred, recalling after the war a battalion of the 15th Panzergrenadier Division that came under massive Allied artillery bombardment on Monte Camino, on the Gustav Line, south of Rome. After some hours, a report arrived from the positions on the rear slope that the defenders were still holding the summit. A runner who was sent to investigate confirmed that no living troops but only corpses were still there. Such a baleful spectacle as this begs the question of why Kesselring thought defending Italy was a good idea in the first place. He may genuinely have thought that Germany could still win the war, or at least emerge from it undefeated, and that tenaciously defending the Italian peninsula could serve that end. Blind faith may have been a greater incentive, and careerism may well have been an even greater incentive. Kesselring was advocating a textbook dose of National Socialist warfare. It demanded not just defensive proficiency, but also bloody-minded tenacity and a large shot of fanaticism. These were the very attributes that by 1943 were driving the ascent of that new type of field commander further exemplified by Model and Schörner. An order Hitler issued to Kesselring on 20 January 1944 sought to fortify the troops on these counts. "The army, the Luftwaffe, and the forces of the navy must, in all their officers and men, be imbued with the fanatical will to come through the struggle victorious and fight until the last enemy has been destroyed or thrown back into the sea. It must be waged with righteous hatred for an enemy who is conducting a merciless war of annihilation against the German people." Whatever his motives, Kesselring got the campaign he wanted. But, if anything, the Allies were playing him rather than the other way around. Their supply situation improved dramatically when they captured Naples in November. and at that month's Tehran conference they pledged to pin down as many German troops as possible in Italy to prevent them from fighting against the Allied invasion of France. Kesselring's conduct of the Italian campaign has brought him the reputation of a defensive warfare genius. Yet given Italy's topography, the basic task was quite straightforward, certainly more so than if Kesselring had been facing Soviet tank armies on the Russian steppe. The Italian peninsula, crisscrossed by rivers and narrow valleys, offers few opportunities to an attacker seeking to break through or outflank his opponent's position. The ground is often rocky. Mountainous and rugged terrain provides cover from artillery or aerial bombardment, and the valleys and coastal plains are muddy in the winter and spring. The Apennines run along almost the entire length of the country, and with them an immense succession of ridges and steep-sided mountains. During the 1940s, the lower slopes of Italian hills and mountains provided copious defensive cover in the form of scrub trees, vineyards, and citrus and olive groves. There were only a few proper roads, and these were usually limited to valleys with only infrequent passes. Kesselring certainly defended Italy skillfully and proficiently then, but a defensive warfare genius he was not. Yet though the basic task of defending the peninsula was straightforward, the troops on the ground would need to exploit the geography to the full. They needed to be inventive and resourceful. They proved to be both. Units that had already fought in mountainous Balkan regions had particularly relevant experience of the type of terrain the Germans were defending. Such a unit was the 114th Light Division. "God and nature are helping us here," wrote Peter G. in May 1944. "It's all the more gratifying that our redoubtable troops are bringing in more and more prisoners, mainly English officers. The excellent training in the Balkans can be thanked for our being able to carry out all combat patrolling and raiding without any losses up here." Adapting proved harder for many units that had transferred from the Eastern Front. Of the 5th Mountain Division, General von Zenger-Etterlin wrote, "At first their field postcards contained remarks indicating that they would rather return to Russia on all fours. But once the division got over the first shock, it proved itself a good match for the Algerian and Moroccan attackers who were well acquainted with mountains." In such narrow mountainous confines, mines were particularly effective at channeling advancing Allied troops into a deadly field of fire. The Germans often made the job of mine clearing even nastier by attaching anti-personnel mines to anti-tank mines. There were abundant rocks for building pillboxes and bunkers among the mountains, and the Germans converted nooks and crannies in the rocks into log-covered defensive posts. Mortars were particularly deadly defensive weapons. Because their trajectories were less steep, it was easier to aim them at Allied troops in ravines and behind steep ridges. In a directive of August 1944, the 721st Light Regiment, under the 114th Light Division, identified the many troughs and ravines littering the landscape as providing excellent opportunities for steeply situated firing positions. Ridges made excellent observation posts and machine gun sites, and though the troops on them were exposed to enemy bombardment, they were able to use crowbars, hammers, and explosive charges to dig themselves in. And the single most effective way of holding up the Allied advance was for a solitary military engineer to block a ravine using only an explosive charge. Drawing on the bitter lessons learned from urban fighting on the Eastern Front, the Germans showed even more ingenuity when they defended Italian towns and villages. Italian villages were usually situated in locations that dominated the terrain around them. This made it much easier for the Germans to observe and fire upon approaching Allied troops, particularly AFVs advancing up exposed roads. Unlike the villages the Germans encountered in the Soviet Union, buildings in Italian villages were substantially constructed from stone mortar, were thickly walled, and for the most part contained cellars. Their streets were arranged in irregular, sometimes labyrinthine, patterns, which made them much harder for an attacking force to find its way around. Villages were even easier to defend if the Allies made the mistake of bombing them into eminently defensible rubble before they attacked. The Germans accordingly exploited every advantage that urban fighting offered. They would make loopholes in walls, place mines and booby traps among the rubble, position machine guns pointing out of cellars or on overhead floors reinforced by rubble, and block streets with vertically buried logs, wrecked vehicles, and, again, rubble. Combined at the right place, these defenses enabled the Germans to subject Allied troops to devastating interlocking fire. In the face of all this, it is little wonder that the advancing Allies, despite their colossal firepower,